May it please the Court, Janine Carriage for Appellant Linda Reeves. The issue in this case is whether the debt Mr. Davis owes to Ms. Reeves, which is a money judgment Ms. Reeves obtained against him in state court for defective and incomplete work performed on her house, is non-dischargeable under 11 U.S.C. 523A2A. A debt is non-dischargeable under 523A2A where it was obtained by false pretenses, false representation, or actual fraud. Here, while fraud and non-dischargeability were not legal issues directly at issue before the state court made numerous factual findings which do establish non-dischargeability. The state court found that a covered porch was part of the contract Mr. Davis entered into with Ms. Reeves. Mr. Davis testified he never intended to build the porch. The state court also found that Mr. Davis stopped work without justification or excuse, that the work was not complete, that the work he did complete was defective, needed to be replaced if it was not up to building code standards, and that the cost to repair and complete the work was over $76,000. By contrast, the contract price was only $63,000, demonstrating that he left Ms. Reeves in far worse condition, not only than when he found her, but than what the actual contract price was. Further, Mr. Davis accepted overpayment of over $19,000 for work he never completed and materials he never bought, money he later testified he used to pay personal expenses. Here, the bankruptcy court disregarded those findings, expressly overturning two of them and ignoring others. However, the bankruptcy court was bound by collateral estoppel to the factual findings of the state court and had to give those preclusive effect.
Well, do I need help on that one? I went back and forth on this while I was getting ready for this argument. On this issue, preclusion issue,
yes.
If you look at what the trial court, the state court rather, was looking at, and the issues he had to decide with respect to this unique state statute, those issues and how they relate to deceptive practices, aren't they quite different from the issues the bankruptcy judge was looking at?
They are, Your Honor, but the
so doesn't that then mean that issue preclusion was not did not enter into the bankruptcy judge's decision?
We don't argue that the state court found actual fraud at that stage. What we do argue is that the state court's factual findings, which were fully litigated in a trial lasting several days where both parties had representation, are entitled to preclusive effect, and that what the bankruptcy court then was bound to do was apply the legal issue for 523A to those factual findings.
Yeah, but for preclusion to apply, the first prong is, isn't it? The issue sought to be precluded is the same as that involved in the prior action.
I think the issue is the facts of what Mr. Davis did or did not do and what his actions in terms of the, not only the contract but what he did in terms of the construction were. And those were the same both before the bankruptcy court and the state court, even though the legal standard is different.
The second prong is the issue was actually litigated. The third prong is the determination of the issue was essential to the final judgment.
Right.
So does that mean that if the frauds, deceptive practice in the state court, fraud under the Bankruptcy Act and the bankruptcy court are different kinds of issues, legally speaking, you obviously argue that issue preclusion applies.
That's right. I think there will never be exact legal parity between what the bankruptcy court is doing and what the state court is doing, and that's because non-dischargeability issues are never before a state court. At that point, bankruptcy isn't an issue, and there's no reason why a litigant should have to fully litigate any possible argument later just in case a bankruptcy may be entered into. In fact, the Supreme Court in the Brown versus Felsen case has said non-dischargeability is not required to be established at state court, and I don't see how it ever could be. However, when the facts at issue are require the same examination of conduct and the facts of what occurred, then why should the bankruptcy court go forth and relitigate every single one of those? That's the policy reason of collateral estoppel, as, for instance, the Fourth Circuit has said in Coombs v. Richardson, that where an issue has been determined before in a trial We want to grant that preclusive effect because it's never going to be more litigated in a hearing later. Indeed, here we had a 5-day trial involving examination of numerous witnesses and exhibits, whereas the bankruptcy court heard testimony only from Ms. Reeves and Mr. Davis in one afternoon. However, the bankruptcy court then substituted its judgment wholesale for that of the state court. And not only is that a waste of judicial resources, it doesn't live up to the same standard of actually examining all of the evidence. All he heard was testimony from the two litigants, and he substituted judgments on what was actually done, what was in the contract, and the credibility of the witnesses. Indeed, this court in the 1993 decision in Ray Bullock has said that the doctrine of collateral estoppel does apply in bankruptcy court, and other circuits, most recently the Ninth Circuit, in a 2010 decision in Ray Lopez, has said that it can apply to non-dischargeability actions. Both the bankruptcy court and Mr. Davis appear to argue that collateral estoppel doesn't apply because the state court didn't make specific findings of fraud, as we've discussed. But this, again, conflates the facts and the law. We don't dispute that the bankruptcy court, if it needed to find additional facts, could have engaged in fact-finding. However, it was still bound to accept the facts that had already been fully and conclusively litigated at the state court level. Indeed, the factual record before the bankruptcy court does establish non-dischargeability. Not only do we have the state court's factual findings, but the record before the bankruptcy court actually uncovered additional reasons for non-dischargeability, notably that Mr. Davis misrepresented his license. He advertised himself in the phone book as licensed and insured. However, as we later found out, there's no license requirement, which Ms. Reese didn't know, just as a homeowner, and he was very blithe about his lack of licensure, saying that he only needed a driver's license. Now,
did you actually litigate that at the state level?
It came out before the bankruptcy court. It's not part of the record that I have for the state court judgment, but it was elicited in testimony before the bankruptcy court, and there was no further briefing before the bankruptcy court ruled, so I don't think that issue was ever fully briefed, but it was part of the record.
And it wasn't briefed at bankruptcy, so the bankruptcy judge didn't include that in his
I don't believe order. That he that was part of the order. However, it was part of the facts before him in making his ruling.
Is it waived for our purposes?
I don't think so because, again, it was part of the record and there was no further briefing. Whether the bankruptcy court ignored that is a separate issue as to whether we affirmatively never brought it up or waived it. In fact, it was part of the opening statement that we had before the bankruptcy court was the license issue. Indeed, there are two things that alone can render this debt non-dischargeable under the facts of this case. The first is the state court's finding that Mr. Davis agreed to construct a porch. Again, he testified that he never intended to construct the porch. Entering into a contract that you don't intend to fulfill alone renders a debt non-dischargeable, as the Blatinsky v. Jareth case says, which is a bankruptcy case from Northern District of Illinois. Second is the license issue. There are numerous cases from all across the country saying that misrepresenting your license, misrepresents your qualifications, induces the homeowner to enter into the contract as opposed to allowing the homeowner to contract with somebody who's competent or does have a license. Here, the fact that the work was defective and not up to building code standards suggests that he was not competent to perform the work, and his misrepresentation of his qualifications led to Ms. Reeves' damages. If there are no further questions right now, I'll reserve my time. Thank you.
Mr. Taylor?
Good morning, Your Honors. This entire case can be encapsulated into one paragraph from Judge Hoff's decision in the state court. Forgive me, if it won't take very long. However, the lack of detail in the contract and the uncertainty about which version of the contract applies is not a trivial issue in this case. Because the defendant's proposal is not sufficiently detailed, it is difficult to compare the work defendant undertook and the work that plaintiff claims remains undone. The evidence is undisputed that some of the work defendant did is defective. The evidence is undisputed that part of the work that he agreed to do and that he paid for was not done. Defendant's failure to comply with, and then cites the Home Improvement Contracts Act, has made a more detailed comparison of the defendant's proposal and the Shields construction bids impossible. Lack of certainty about what defendant proposed to do should be resolved against the defendant. It was a breach of contract case. My client breached the contract. He didn't do anything dishonestly. Let me briefly address one case which I did not in my answer brief. It was raised in the appellant's brief. I dismissed it. So I went down to your library before I came up here. That's the Levine case that they argue is on all fours with this case and should be controlling. But the part of the Levine case they didn't tell you about was the first full paragraph on page 844 that says that the contractor misrepresented that he paid employees and material men that he had not, specifically requesting money for payment of those people and then not making those payments. That's a side note. Your Honors, I don't know how I am here to answer any questions that you have. I think the briefs fully discuss this case. This case was tried twice. It was tried before Judge Hoff. It was tried before the bankruptcy court, and it was appealed once. And all three courts have determined that Mr. Davis did nothing dishonest, that Mr. Davis did not make any misrepresentations of any kind. You had a question, Your Honor, about the license issue. That was raised in the trial before the bankruptcy judge. Mr. Davis did testify about that. He testified as a result of the direct examination of the appellant. From reading the judge's decision, I can only conclude that he found no misrepresentation on Mr. Davis's part.
You conclude that because he didn't address it in his order?
We testified about it. He did not address it in his order, no.
All right.
Any questions?
Apparently not. Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Ms. Carriage? Ms. Carriage?
I would just make a couple points. As to Mr. Davis's honest conduct or lack thereof, as numerous courts have said in this very similar context, it's very rare that a contractor is going to stand up and say, oh, I entered into this with dishonest intent. What needs to be looked at is the totality of the circumstances and the totality of his conduct. Not only did he make these misrepresentations, not live up to the contract, but his work was completely shoddy, not complete. He abandoned the job without justification or excuse. It's the totality of the conduct that courts look at in these cases to determine whether a contractor was, in fact, dishonest. In this case, a contractor simply can't misrepresent what he can or what his qualifications are, what his capabilities are, do an incredibly poor job leaving a homeowner's house in shambles, take an overpayment of $19,000, not complete the work, and then just leave, only later to declare bankruptcy, leaving the homeowner who justifiably relied on his representations and chose him over other contractors due to those misrepresentations with no recourse and no way to reclaim the money that was spent and get the money necessary to complete and repair the work that was done. Ms. Rees here justifiably relied on his misrepresentations. As the court is well aware, the standard for justifiable reliance is much lower than reasonable reliance. All that was required was that Ms. Rees didn't blindly rely on his representations. He or she interviewed 12 contractors. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Carriage. Thank you, Mr. Taylor. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.